It's clear that what you love matters, and what you do about it matters too. If you find yourself loving something, wanting it, deciding that it's for you, you're already among the rare and the lucky, because it's hard enough just to figure out what you want in the first place. And once you do, you've got a dilemma. Now what? Do you relegate it to fantasy, or do you treat it with a little responsibility? And at the very least, let it be known, I want this. I guess some people call that manifesting. The point is that actions have consequences, actions have reactions, and something as simple as sending a direct message or an email can have a real and lasting effect. Maybe we don't always recognize an inflection point while we're standing in it. Sometimes it's only later that we can look back and say, oh, that was the moment. That was the before and after. Looking back on her life so far, Phoebe Cates can pinpoint one of those moments pretty clearly. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Phoebe Cates was a young 20-something aspiring singer-songwriter living in England, trying to figure out how to break through. She was inspired by artists from her home country, like Adele, who she looked to as a benchmark of success for longer than she now thinks was probably healthy. But she was also looking beyond the UK, aware that she had access to the whole world. Equally at ease on stage and online, Phoebe turned to social media to communicate with musicians she admired. Whenever an artist or a band she liked came through London, she reached out, sometimes just to say hello, sometimes to offer help, sometimes to see if there might be a way to collaborate. And that is how she ended up connecting with guitarist Corey Wong, an optimistically online artist who, at least a few years back, read all his DMs and answered most of them too. So when Corey came to London on tour with Wolfpack, Phoebe wrote to everyone in the band, and Corey wrote back. That single exchange set off a domino effect in her life. One small handful of messages, sent a bit on a whim, eventually led to where she is today, living her life as an artist in the United States, collaborating with many of the musicians that she most admires, married to saxophonist Sam Greenfield, who she met on tour with Corey, and firmly embedded in a global musical community. Phoebe's collaborations today read like a who's who of past Third Story podcast guests, including John Lampley, Scary Pockets, Louis Cato, John Fields, and Corey Wong himself. Phoebe's music is pop forward, 80s evocative, smartly written and produced. There's a sugary quality to both her voice and the way she chooses to surround it. It feels good to listen to. As a child of the 80s myself, I feel seen when a younger artist embraces the values I grew up loving, from the ear candy to the compositions themselves. That is to say, she's not afraid of a slick hook, and she's not afraid to slip in a few chord changes now and then either, and both are very good news. But what strikes me even more is what's happening underneath the surface of her songs. Beneath the neoprene sheen and neon lipstick, there's a depth and honesty in Phoebe's writing that is both earnest and quietly heartbreaking. If you're not paying attention, you might miss that she's writing songs that are funny, sad, searching, and very human. And that's okay, because as she says, they're meant to be bops. But if you're listening closely, you come away feeling like you know her, and that she's naming preoccupations many of us share: getting older, falling short of the success we imagined, wanting to please people, managing our relationship with our phones, and trying to figure out who we're becoming again and again. All this talk of the world being my oyster, of the goals that I'm supposed to be hitting, but I just keep on missing all these doors that I know I could have opened, keeping me awake in my one bed, only open in my head. Her new album, Coming of Age, her fifth full-length release, came out last year. She toured behind it in the fall, and she's heading back out this month on the East Coast. We got together recently in Brooklyn to talk about her personal journey, including that fateful DM that reoriented her life, her creative process, and her professional reality. She also spoke candidly about her side hustles, which I think are pretty cool too, actually. You can visit third-story.com to hear the full archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, including conversations with many of Phoebe's friends and collaborators. You can read my recent writings and hear all the episodes at leosidran.substack.com. I've been spending a lot of time there lately. The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all their award-winning content. Phoebe Cadis learned to trust her instincts from a young age, which helped her to find her people and her place. If you have a young budding musician in your life who's looking for some guidance, Musication is a wonderful resource to help you find the right teacher. Musication offers in-home music lessons in Brooklyn and Manhattan for kids ages 3 and up. Their teachers are highly experienced professional musicians, and every lesson is tailored to each child's interests and needs, with flexible scheduling that fits into real life. Life is busy, your kids are busy, Musication teachers come to you. As a special offer for Third Story listeners, visit musication.nyc, mention the podcast, and you'll receive 2 free trial lessons. Here's me and Phoebe Cadis talking it down in Brooklyn. So Phoebe Cadis.
Oh, yeah.
Here it is. We had a conversation recently in the coffee shop, mm-hmm. and I was trying to remember what we talked about this morning as I was preparing to talk to you. And the good news and the bad news is that I don't remember. I remember loving the conversation.
Yeah.
But I think the good news is I don't remember the answers to my
Sweet.
Questions. So
Excellent.
We're going to ask them again.
That's great.
So one thing that has happened mm-hmm. since we met in the coffee shop over the summer is that your record came out.
Yes.
And I think when we talked, you had been sort of slowly unleashing these videos and mm-hmm. singles. But now, a few days ago, your album came out. What does it feel like after all the buildup?
Oh, it's been a big buildup, this one, because I had sort of a hiatus between my last album and this one of about 3 years. So the journey for this album was like... It was a marathon.
Yeah.
So I feel very excited for these songs to be out in the world. And let's put it this way. It was an intense labor. This
yeah.
child, this is my fifth child.
Yeah.
It was an intense labor. She took yeah. a while. So I'm really just so stoked that these songs are out and I'm really proud of it. And it's doing the rounds. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned this is your fifth project. Mm-hmm. That is a lot. You're early 30s or
yeah.
30-ish.
I turned 33 on Wednesday.
Right. So it's impressive to have made 5 albums by the time you're 33. You've been cranking. The feeling I've gotten from you, just knowing you kind of peripherally and socially for the mm-hmm. last few years, is you are like in it. You get it done. You are constantly trying to make something happen, let people know, promote the things, write another thing, collaborate with people. You're like... You're pretty full on, I think.
Yeah, thank you. That's nice to hear because I am very deep in it. So it's fun to hear a perspective that's sort of like, oh yeah, you are doing the thing. Like, well done, you're doing it. And I'm like, oh yeah, I am.
Well, I think that, you know, as so many of us are in the arts, we're all constantly having to make it happen. I do think some people, even just personality-wise, are more natural fit for not the grind of getting the work done, but the grind of representing yourself in the world mm-hmm. and being like unashamed to say, I made a thing. I want you to see it. It's important to me. I love it. I hope you love it like I love it. Like,
yeah.
as simple as it is to say that, there are so many obstacles between making a thing and being willing to go out in the world and say, I really hope you listen to this because yeah. I loved making it and it's important to me and, you know, all those things.
Yes, I think that is just an unabashed, like, if I don't do this thing, I'm going to be really sad. And that's inherently a selfish thing, but I've always struggled with sort of how to explain why you do what you do as an artist, because inherently it's a very self-involved thing. It's like, I've created this piece of art and I've said this thing about this either universal feeling or experience that I've gone through or something, and I want to put it out in the world. And hey, I would love it if you listened to it.
Like, yes.
I've been trying to figure out what it is that makes it sort of easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it gets you past the whole sort of, I'm worried that I'm talking about myself too much, or
yes.
I'm worried that my whole life is about putting out my music and that. I don't know if I've gotten to the bottom of it, so I would love your input if you have any. But if I think about my friends who put out music and artists that I love and that, it's absolutely 100%, of course they should be doing this. I adore their music. I adore their message. I adore what they're talking about. And then if I turn that back around, I'm like, well, maybe people feel the same way about what I'm saying. So that's why I should keep doing it or
yeah.
something like that. Do you know what I mean? And it's
totally.
Hard.
You know, in the last year or so, I have really started to think about why we do what we do and what is that compulsion to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the conclusion that, okay, so one version of what we do is we express ourselves,
mm-hmm.
then ask people to come into a space, sit quietly and not speak while we publicly perform our self-expression.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, we take the bow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know? Whereas it's a lot to ask people to give us their time. it's a very selfish thing to want to take that from people. On the other hand, it has obviously been, since the dawn of humanity, important to us that there is art and artists and that some people are the leaders of the song and mm-hmm. others sing along. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, like I think about some of your lyrics, we're at very different places in our lives. We have very different lived experiences. But it's funny when you hear somebody sing something and it touches you, even in an unexpected way. You have this one line about being in touch with this 15-year-old version of yourself. Yeah. You say, I'm going to turn 50 and still feel like I'm 15.
Yeah.
Even when I'm 50, I'll still think I'm 50. Panicking about the places I have never been. Thinking of the ways I haven't seized the day. Cause it's my first time here, but also my last time here. So what the fuck, I'm just a kid.
And I'm facing down 50. I'm going to be 50 in a year and a half. And I was like, yes. You're like imagining how it is, and but I'm actually I'm there, and I'm like, yes, that is speaking to me so much. Like, you never get past that feeling, mm-hmm. or at least I don't. And also, you know, you play out one day being a 60-something mother, and mm-hmm. your daughter will come home heartbroken and need to stay with you for a while. I think that's what sort of is that the story? That's
basically? Yeah. I mean, I hope she's not too heartbroken. What I think I meant to say was, if all goes well, then I have a child.
Yes.
I think I said a daughter in the song. I don't mind. I don't mind what I have, but I would like a child.
Yes.
There we go. That's on record.
All right.
At some point. Yeah. And then there's a moment where she asks me about my life and asks me for advice.
Yes.
And I'm in a position where I can give that to her.
Oh,
because
I see.
I've
because
lived these lives.
At this point, when you're writing the song, you're still somebody who's looking for advice.
Right. If she asks me what I know about life and I'm like, will I know what to say?
Yeah.
Do I know? I'm still coming of age at this point, and I'll be coming of age again when she asks me. And then if she comes to my door and has a story about heartbreak, and I have to then come of age again and be able to tell her some advice that I would have told, but I don't know. Yeah, I was basically role-playing.
Soon enough I'll hit 45, and my daughter, if these plans go right, will ask me what I'm sure about and the rules that I can't live without. Suddenly I'm 64 and she's banging on my front door with a suitcase and a tale of woe. Say, Mom, you always told me no one knows what to say, no one knows how they'll feel when the person in your bed starts to change. Some are made to pass on through and some were made to stay. When we are coming of age, or coming of age, when we're coming of age.
The whole album, A Coming of Age, that song in particular sort of maps it out of how you never really do come of age. And the saying to come of age, it's sort of associated more with your high school. You leave high school, you become an adult and you learn these things about yourself and you're coming of age. And I'm just like, but I learned things about myself in my 20s and in my 30s and I will in my 40s and 50s and continue to not fully arrive, I think. And there's such a pressure, especially in today's age, industry-wise, but also just, you know, how we're all kind of pressurized to arrive somewhere, to get that massive career, to make that family, to meet these people, to move to this place, to put roots down. Or if you're not a roots person or a family person, there's a pressure to become someone, become a thing that you can market or plaster on social media or do something. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's such a pressure of arriving and achieving. And I've never felt like I've arrived. I've achieved things, but I haven't necessarily arrived in a place that I can say, like, this is who I am.
Yeah.
I've done it.
Well, you've just laid it all out. I mean, there it is. Do you feel that you have put that pressure on yourself? Like, you know, you've got a song on the record about how good it is to be famous. And
yeah.
I think that's the song where you say, I'm mad at these girls half my age who are more famous than I am. Or not mad at them, but
and terrified.
Trying not to get depressed over a superstar who's half my age. Oh, everything's better when you are famous. Love and attention 24/7. I feel much better when I am famous too. When you...
That song, Famous, is basically, it's a fun little prediction of my own demise that will likely never happen because I don't think I'll reach those heights of fame that will be plastered on front pages and all of that sort of thing. That it's sort of it's a commentary on A, my own, possibly my own demise, but also just a commentary on the culture of fame itself and how awful it is, really. Press, especially tabloids, terrible world of, you know, pulling down celebs that have done so much to work on their craft and bring these things to the table and all this and all that. And then suddenly within one day, if they have one moment where they're slightly drunk outside a club, they're torn to pieces and or they've worn something that doesn't look very good. And it's like, do they even have any fashion sense? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, gosh, if you get to a certain stage in fame, which I definitely am not at that stage, but I imagined it for that song. It's very tumultuous up there.
But it's a funny thing to fantasize about having. It's like my version of that was I used to say, I'm ready to have one hit, to be a one hit wonder. I'm ready to have a terrible song follow me around for the rest of my life.
Pay the bills for the rest of your life.
So like, I think your version of it is like, I know it's a downfall. I know it's terrible and that the tabloids are going to be talking about me and pursuing me everywhere. And it's going to lead me to drink and, you know, but I'm ready to imagine that.
Yeah, absolutely. I really resonate with that actually. Cause you know, you look at all these legacy artists who are torn to pieces because they don't play their favorite songs. They don't play the one hit or the top hits.
Yeah.
And whilst I feel for them, I'm also like, I would do that. I would also sell my soul for that one hit, maybe. I don't, but also just at this stage, like I'm in my early 30s, I'm where I am with my career. I've done an amazing array of things. I've been so lucky to work with people. I've been so lucky to be able to tour and put out music and the incredible people that I've been able to work with, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, am I at a place where it's completely paying my bills or I'm in a certain success rate where I'm not needing my side hustles? No, I'm not there yet. And I'm still hoping I'm getting there. I'm still putting in the work and doing the music. And but anything would help at this point. And I don't think that's a negative. I don't think it's selling out. I don't think there really is a sellout now in today's culture. I don't think you can. I think anything that allows you to do what you love and pay your bills is a success.
That's so interesting that it has really shifted so far from the roots of rock and roll, you know, which was countercultural and against the sort of the man and the commercialism and the entrenched powers that be. And it now has become, also culture has changed so much that now it's not only that it's acceptable, it's like it is a success if you are able to make your work and make money from it.
Yeah.
And survive.
Yeah. Yeah. And survive being the key word, both financially and emotionally. And I think that the financial side is quite easy to say whether you're being successful or not. Can you pay your rent? Can you pay your bills? Can you support your family? Can you do the things you want to do? You can pretty much say whether you're doing that or not. It's very easy to sort of look at the numbers. Yeah. Emotionally is a different thing, though. And I think that I've grappled with that quite a lot over the last 3 years. And a lot of that has fed into this album because you have such a Disney idea of success in the music industry. And I would grow up on Adele being the pinnacle of UK singer-songwriter. When I was growing up, I think I'm like 6 years her junior.
So she put out the first record was 19, you were 13.
21, 25.
You're just behind her.
And I would look at her, I'd be like, right, 18, 19, first breakthrough record, BBC, touring, huge sales, this, and this. That's my
benchmark.
I'm benchmarking that. And then, oh, it didn't happen. Okay, no worries. 21. Okay, didn't happen then. 25. Okay, didn't happen then. Far from it at 25. If we want to talk about what I was doing at 25, that's a whole other kettle of fish. But I had no idea who I was at 25. But like, again, the pressure of arriving, the industry has sort of, with the breakout of streaming and the breakout of the internet, which has been around now for a while, obviously, but the streaming platforms, especially with the early 2010s, it was very possible for you to break out on your own, and the independent artist game completely changed. Yeah. And I'm not going to poo-poo Spotify or streaming services, honestly, because although they pay out a fraction per stream and it's not as good as it could be, I have fans in Japan.
Yeah.
I have fans in Nigeria. Someone was messaging me from Nigeria today.
Well, I hope it wasn't a prince, was it? It wasn't somebody who had wanted you to, because he messaged me a couple times too, that prince.
Oh, we should.
It turns out we can actually save that man if we give him our bank account information.
Oh, I think I didn't get the same guy, but maybe he will come up in my DMs at some point. No, I had a genuine, and I looked him up and he's like an arranger, a music arranger in Nigeria with a band and stuff. And I'm like, how in the world does my music get to these places?
Yeah.
Streaming, you know? And so I might be shackled by musicians and artists for not poo-pooing Spotify, but I am a true believer that the internet has done incredible things for artists, and it's an incredibly tough industry to be in, but I think it's also a very accessible place to be in as an artist. And as an independent artist, there are so many tools that we can now use. But to go back to like feeling emotionally stable about what success is for you, we have to change our parameters. We have to change what success looks like. Otherwise, we're going to drive ourselves crazy.
Yeah.
Like if I still thought success was following the Adele motion, I'm out. I'm done. I'm 32 and I haven't had, you know, it's like I would be very, very depressed. And I do get down. I do get emotional about where things are at and where I think I should be. But the should word is the danger. The should word is the worst, because if you are constantly comparing yourself, you will probably never get there.
Yeah.
Because you're not allowing your own journey to unfold. And the pressure of asking your art to make you money will destroy it.
But also because, like in any genre, part of what you're doing potentially is speaking a kind of personal truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so your personal truth is whatever journey you're on, you know, which includes being 33 and not having achieved Adele's success at 33. But of course, you can't be Adele. Adele's got that covered already.
Of course.
But I do think, and the reason I mentioned this thing about genre is that it's deceptive to me, the music that you're making, because it goes down so smooth. Like, it, you know what I mean? It's so fun and poppy and easy to listen to. And actually, as I was listening to the new record particularly, but then Spotify started feeding me other things too, which, and I love some of the earlier stuff too. It reminded me of the experience of listening to a pop record when I was a kid. And as you know, I'm like 15 years older than you. Like listening to a Whitney Houston record or a Taylor Dane record or a Madonna record or something, where it's like, I mean, first of all, because there's so much love for 80s pop music, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah.
That stuff was cool sounding when I was growing up. Like that was the most modern, edgy sounding stuff. Your stuff doesn't sound overtly like it's parodying the 80s. Like sometimes people take 80s elements and they sort of play with it as a joke. I don't hear that from you. I hear like, I love this pop sound, but it feels more 80s to me almost than it does like 2010s. It feels like you're reaching into a pop language that's very familiar to me. And because of that, I think it would be easy to look past the fact that you're also telling your truth through these songs. You're doing both. You know what I mean? Like you're writing poppy, dancey, definitely slick, hip songs, but also like, you know, you have the song from a few years ago about how you want a flip phone because social media and watching a screen all the time is so toxic and problematic and emotionally draining. Like, I'm ready for my flip phone. That's a societal commentary that you're making through a very kind of bubblegummy exterior.
Yeah. Firstly, thank you for saying the stuff about the 80s, because I love the 80s.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious about, first of all, about the 80s. Like, is that a deliberate conversation that you've had with producers?
Yes, on a number of the tracks on the record, and then some not so much. For example, Runaway Train, which is a straight up Madonna, ABBA, 80s disco ballad.
Yeah.
That was just the box that I wanted to tick with that song. I'm on a runaway train. That's the other thing with this album, and I think across all of my music, but specifically with this album, I tried not to force songs into a certain box, which I feel like I haven't done a lot in my last records, but maybe Sweet Reunion, the one two albums before was, again, quite eclectic because it was made in the pandemic and it was really remote. And I was just asking friends for stems and it was very like, I'll just write this, this and this.
Yeah.
But that was more like made an eclectic record because of my collaborators just sending me stuff and me being like,
I'll take
cool, this is fun.
Yeah.
And then this one was like, I have so many genre interests that I wanted to finish the song in the way the song wants to be finished, mm-hmm. instead of shoehorn a song into a style or a marketing box, I guess, mm-hmm. which I, hand on heart, and will be the first person to say, that is not a smart move. That is not smart career-wise, because it leaves you with a difficult-to-market product, and it leaves you with a, we say pick and mix in the UK, which is, you know, when you go to the cinema and you get lots of sweets in the same bag from different bins, we call that pick and mix,
yeah.
which apparently America doesn't have.
We don't know about this. No,
so
we don't know about pick
this
and
is
mix.
This is a pick and mix record, and that's not easy to market. That's like a big no-no. If yeah. I went into a label and was like, hey, here's my record. They're like, cool, play us the three songs that
yeah.
sound the same and would tell us what the album's about. And I'm like, oops.
Right. Compared to records that kind of have a coherence that run through it.
Yes. And I think I basically put the song first and just wrote the songs and wanted them to live in the universe that they were written in. For yeah. example, the Runaway Train ABBA 80s one. I sat down and was like, I love ABBA.
Yeah.
I want to make something similar.
Yeah.
And I did. And then I found, and then Dave McKay, who produced it, incredible. He is a big 80s lover. So I was like, you, me, 80s yeah. song, let's go. But it was, yeah, song first.
And you did a couple songs with Wurtz, with...
I did one song with Bill.
Yeah.
Bill Wurtz, yeah. Oh my God.
So that, you told me about him, and then I went back and checked him out, and yeah. I was like, oh yeah, I know who Bill Wurtz is. And,
yeah.
But what's interesting about that is that he... There was this thing in early 80s sample technology where samples would get truncated and cut off tightly and strangely
mm-hmm.
because we didn't have enough memory in the sampler yeah. to like let the tail of the sample
yeah,
go.
Yeah.
And he does this thing that is so evocative of the 80s to me,
yeah.
of the tightly, weirdly
mm-hmm.
cut samples and the sounds that he uses that are like the sound yeah. of my childhood.
Oh, now you've made that link. I didn't even make that link between the 80s and what he does. I just saw Bill Wurtz's world.
Yeah.
It's like he's not operating in this universe. But yeah, his production style is quite literally out of this world.
And you just reached out to him out of nowhere.
Mate, that might be my biggest win in life.
You were a fan of Bill Wurtz.
I was a huge fan of Bill Wurtz. Like,
he had made those videos, like the history of the world.
His videos, but his music as well was just instant serotonin. I could put it on in any mood, any place, anywhere. It was the thing I put on to make myself feel better. Or just if I was feeling really good, it was my hype music. I just did a bad thing. I regret the thing. So I was like a genuine Bill Wurtz like cult member. Yeah. And my incredible friend Ryan Lerman put us together because Bill had done a Scary Pocket session with them and nothing else. Like, he's never collaborated with anyone, but I clocked the Scary Pocket session and I was like,
and you
Ryan,
had already done the Scary Pocket stuff?
Yeah. Like, hello, hello, hello. How's my little lady in the New York snow? Yeah, he says I love you loads. He's a certified gambler messing with me. Hello, hello, hello. I got one foot in and one out the door. I think it's about time that I take control. I'll be a certified gambler fucking good three. I met Ryan through the Scary Pockets stuff and was like, hey, is there any way you could reach out to Bill? Because I saw this one interview as well with Bill where he was like, I've never collaborated with someone and I don't know if I would like it, but I think I should do it just to try it out. And I was like, this is my moment. This is my moment. And so I texted Ryan. I was like, hey, is there any way you could put me in touch with Bill? And he did. And within like 24 hours, gosh, I owe him so much. Within 24 hours, he was like, here's the message from Bill. Yeah, ask her to email me. I was like, oh my God. So I did. And then we went back and forth on the songs and I sent him some other demos and quickly realized that none of the demos that I was sending him were write for him. So I actually did the opposite of what you usually do as a songwriter or an artist. Usually you write a song and find a producer to fit the song. But I found the producer and I wrote a song for him.
But he was a muse too. You found a muse for the song.
Exactly. Absolutely. 100%.
Which we do.
Yeah.
How long was the email that you wrote to him? He was obviously very short with his response. Yeah, tell her to email me.
I know.
This is my chance to email him. I'm a huge fan. What do you say?
Oh my gosh. I should probably pull it up to get it right. But I think it was something along the lines of, "Hi, Bill. Huh. I'm a huge fan and wondered if you wanted to produce a track for someone else. I'm an artist doing this, this and this." I sort of told him a bit about myself. Let me know if that sounds good. And obviously sent him my music so he could check it out before. And he said, yeah. And now we're here.
But in fact, you had done that before. I mean, you and I met, I believe, through Corey Wong and his sort of extended family, musical family. And as I understand it, you sort of met him in a similar way. You reached out as a fan.
Oh, yeah. That was an Instagram DM. Big up Instagram. I went to see Wolfpack in 2017.
In the UK?
In the UK. London, Shepherd's Bush, O2 Empire. Represent. And I went out to the show and then I did what I was doing at the time, which was messaging all of my favorite musicians whenever they came into town or just in general. I was just completely hustling the DM email. And I messaged all of them. I was like, hey guys, I'm a singer in London. If you ever want vocals on anything, blah, blah, blah. And Corey was in this zone, which he's still to this day really good at, which is actually looking at his DMs and looking at people who message him and responding and just being really open to communication. Actually, I don't know what he's like now. Obviously, he's in a different level. But at that time, he was really cool with just like opening his DMs and messages and replying to people and checking them out, which is so cool. And he did. And he was like, you know, funny you should say that. I want a British singer on this new song. Do you want to give it a go? And I was like, oh my God. And that was Duke on Jelly. And that was the song on his album, The Optimist. And it went from there. It was amazing. And we started touring and I helped him book his first London show in 2018 or something, which is just insane to think of knowing the heights he's at now. We just did some Europe touring and I was opening and singing and collaborating on his music and he was producing my music and it was just amazing. That was my sort of, I guess that was my break, which if you look at your life, if you look at your career, that was a really big moment. I have a lot to own for. Yeah.
And a turning point, you then at some point move to New York.
I did, yes. Yeah, I got the visa to tour with him and then 2020 happened. So the touring happened in 2019. 2020 happened, all the touring was cancelled.
And you were here
World
or
shut
you
down.
Went home?
I was not. I was actually in Australia in March 2020. I was doing the Adelaide Fringe Festival with a show that I do. I do a Carole King, James Taylor show where I sing her songs and his songs with my friend Dan from the UK. And we tour it to this day. We still go out and we actually the US touring is a really, really good time. We bring it over here and we tour it and we tour PACs and theatres. And I'm really proud of the show. Yeah, we sort of wrote it together and it's about Carole King and James Taylor. So you could put it in the tribute box, but we aren't being them. We're telling their story. Hmm. It's like an immersive biography. So that is a side hustle because this is not my thing, but it's a side hustle I'm really proud of and love to do because I love Carole King. When it's too late. So that has been something I've done for coming on to 8 years now, the Carole King story. So I was in Adelaide in 2020 performing that show at Adelaide Fringe and everything shut down on the last day of our run of shows at the Fringe. I think Tom Hanks got COVID and he was in Australia.
Yes.
And then it was a big thing because an A-list celebrity got it and everyone took it seriously. So I had a ticket home to the UK and I had a ticket to LA and a suitcase. And a really bad breakup. And I was like, do I move to the States?
In COVID?
in March 2020, my little brain was like, I can make this work. And I was texting Corey and I was texting my friends in Nashville being like, I'll go to Nashville and stay with them. And well, this blows over, I'll just find an Airbnb or something. And then on the other hand, it was like, fly home, go to London. You know, my parents were like, what are you doing? Come home. I flew to LA. I flew to LA. I got to LA. It was the quietest I'd ever seen an airport. There was one plane on the ground. It was March, God, probably March like 20th or 19th.
A week into
20th.
It.
Literally. And I was texting my friends in Nashville being like, hey, can I come stay? And they were like, look, we don't really know what's going on. Can you get an Airbnb? We'd love to have you, but like, you've been around the world and there's this COVID thing. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. I looked on Airbnb. Prices skyrocketed, obviously, because everyone was trying to stay places or figure it out. And I spent like 36 hours in LA in an airport being like, what do I do? And I ended up going home.
Yeah.
I ended up going home, obviously. I don't know what I was thinking in the first place. I think I was so heartbroken and so willing to start a new life that I felt if I'd gone home, it would have been a step back, but it wasn't. It was the best decision ever, obviously, considering what happened. So, but I had to move out of London, moved back with my folks.
Where are your folks?
They're in Kent, UK, southeast.
Do you have a Kent accent? Or have you scrubbed your Kentness from your accent, do you think?
I don't think Kent has a particular accent.
Really?
I think London, you have like a posh English accent, which I don't think I have, but some people would say I do. And then you have like a Cockney accent, which is a bit of a geezer, all right, mate, all of that. I think I'm just a sort of standard Southern England accent. I don't think there's anything particularly special going on with it.
Because my understanding was always that you could tell where somebody's from within a range of like a mile in England that the accents change so
much. The accents change crazy. Once you get up north or out west, the accents up north are different every town over. Yeah. But that's lovely. I love the Yorkshire accent.
Yeah.
I was at Leeds Uni, so I sometimes slip into a Yorkshire accent.
Right.
Which is fun.
So you moved home to Kent.
Yes. I had an apartment with my ex-boyfriend and moved out of London pretty promptly, I think April.
Right.
April, May 2020. Yeah. I was in Camden. It was really fun.
And how long were you back home?
From April 2020 to February 2021.
Right.
And then my life changed. I moved to New York.
And it was still pretty raw. I mean, February 2021, there was no vaccine.
Yeah, yeah.
It was opening and closing, expanding and contracting. Things were still outdoor dining.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I moved over and the first vaccine was that April or May.
Yeah.
But the city was way more open than London. It was like London died a death in 2020 and people moved out and quite a lot of people didn't move back in.
Yeah.
When there was chat about London opening up in comparison to other cities, it was very, very lockdown-y. It didn't want to really open up. And I was sort of getting very itchy, obviously, because I was like, I've got this visa and if I don't work, it will be removed.
So you had a three-year O-1.
By December 2020, I was a year and a half into it. So I was halfway through it.
And it's being wasted.
It's being wasted. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I kind of had to move because, you know, I sort of had to put work on this visa for it to not be taken away.
Yeah.
So it also helped that I fell in love with my now husband who lived in New York at the time and I moved in with him.
Right. So how did you manage to fall in love and move in with Sam from Kent?
Oh, this is a beautiful story, really. I mean, we met touring with Corey. He was playing saxophone with Corey and I was opening on the West Coast tour.
But you were in a different relationship.
With a different guy, yeah. So we became really, really good friends. And then the breakup happened over COVID, over like January, February 2020. I was breaking up with my ex and me and Sam started talking basically every day, April-ish onwards in 2020. He was the person that I would talk to every day. And he was in Philly and I was in UK.
Is that where he's from Philly?
Yeah.
And he moved home to Philadelphia during COVID also?
He moved into New York on March 1st, 2020. He was like, yay, Big Apple, this is going to be great. And then it was like, oop, nope, going to go back to Philly. Yeah, so we would FaceTime the whole time. And mainly I was getting over my ex a bit. So we were just friendly, friendly, friendly. And then by September 2020, October 2020, it was like, I like you. This is fun. This is what is this?
So remote video dating, basically for 6 months.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we had that in-person time and we really connected when we were on tour. Like we had a lot of similar interests, yeah. and he was vegan and we were both not drinking and we were both listening yeah. to Sam Harris and we were both doing cold shower therapy. And like, there were all these things that we really connected on. And
that's a lot of information that you just gave right there. Is that, are all of those things still true? You're vegan, not drinking, listening to Sam Harris and doing cold shower therapy?
Okay, here's a test. 2 out of those 4 things are still true.
Okay, are you doing Wim Hof still?
Correct. Cold showers ish. I'm trying to. Yeah.
And you are still vegan.
Yeah. Still vegan. Yeah. 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 Vegan. Definitely drinking again.
No, I knew. I figured that was the one.
Yeah. You're like, ah, she's definitely not teetotal. So I had a very good time not drinking. Yeah. Just putting that in the yeah. podcast too. If you ever feel like you do want to stop drinking, it actually is wonderful. Yeah. But I went back to it with more moderation, yeah. which was something that came from not drinking. Vegan. Yes. Sam Harris, no, although still think he's dope.
Cool, yeah.
And cold showers as and when. Cold therapy is, yeah. yes, I will die on that hill. It's great.
Have you bonded with Theo Katzmann about
that? Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. His bath situation in his farm. Yeah. Oh, my God. We aspire for a cold plunge in a backyard at some point.
Yeah.
That's our peak adult life. That's what we want.
Okay.
That and a garage.
Right, well, you can put the plunge in the garage if you need to.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so you bonded over these lifestyle things.
Yeah, we bonded over lifestyle, became really close friends, and then December 2020, I still couldn't leave to the US because there was still a ban on any international travel, even if you had a visa. So Sam came to the UK, really came to the middle of nowhere, Kent, for 2 weeks with my parents. He really got a lot of brownie points for that. He gambled a lot for that. And if it wasn't going to be a thing, it would have been a very awkward 2 weeks. But luckily, it was wonderful. And
wow.
Then he had a room open up in his apartment in New York. And I moved in February 2021. And that was that.
So you moved in, but you sort of had a room. You had
I never slept in that room. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We technically, were, that was your room.
It was, we were still trying to play it cool. Like, you don't want to come and live in this apartment with me? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then I never slept in a separate room.
It's good to have a place for your things, though.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. My things could be in this room. I'll pay for a storage room. Yeah. And then we just knew. I was insanely lucky to go from one pretty killer heartbreak to the one.
Yes.
Now you're
married.
Now we're married. Yeah.
So it is a kind of a deep thing. And all of this goes back to that moment when you DM the guys in Wolfpack and, and Corey writes back to you. And, you know, you said, that's my break. But when you said that, like, what I was thinking was, okay, maybe it's your professional break, but it's also just the break in the narrative. It's the thing where everything, there's a before and an after for all of that. You met Sam through Corey. You ended up moving here because of that relationship. Your career today is organized around being in New York, it seems, right now. Do you feel that you'll be in New York now for a while, or do you think about leaving?
Oof. We're gonna leave.
You're leaving, yeah.
We're gonna leave. Yeah. We're gonna leave because we want kids at some point, and I just have this golden ticket of the UK. And I'm very lucky to be able to not pay for my child.
Oh, right. And healthcare.
Yeah, it's just easier. And my family's there. My mom's there. And I'd want to be close to them. And so that will happen.
Yeah.
We're saying within a couple years, maybe.
Yeah.
But we love New York. I love New York. It will be really hard to leave. But we have, you know, some bucket list plans of moving back and being able to be in a nice part of town where our kids can grow up or something. I don't know. We're still spitballing it. But the thing is, we're touring so much that we're not even here half the time.
Right.
So the amount of rent we're paying, you know, it's starting to not make much sense in us being here full time.
Yeah.
But we definitely want to be back at some point. I'm putting that on the record too. I love New York.
You want to leave and then come back?
Well, it's funny because we talked about this in the cafe and you were saying that if you leave New York and look behind you, you're not ready to leave.
I never want to look over my shoulder and say, I'll be back for you.
Exactly. And I'm in this weird position where I'm like, right now, it doesn't make sense, but I do want to be back because I love New York. But I feel gravitationally, I really understand what you're saying because of the beast that is New York and the personality that it is. And
there's a difference, though, also. I mean, I've been here 20 years.
Yeah.
So the idea of living here 20 years, leaving, and then thinking, but I'll move back one day.
Oh,
it's like, just put in the time now, just finish it, whatever it is.
Exactly.
You talk about side hustles. I did not know about the Carole King side hustle, but I do know about your job. Can we talk about this?
Yeah.
Are you open to talking about this?
Well, it's funny because when I started it, I was like, I don't want to talk about it publicly and do this and do that because I want my artist thing to still be the thing, which it is. But I kind of said this at the beginning of the podcast, I'm fucking that off at this point because whatever you can do to be an artist and to say that you do that and put out music and make your records and tour, whatever your side hustles are, that is just as important. And the book, Big Magic, Elizabeth Gilbert, I read it earlier this year. It completely realigned how I feel about my side hustles, because she says the pressure of putting financial success and stability on your art is insane.
Yes.
And I think I said this already, but it's like having a child, sending them off into the world, and then saying, you have to pay me back for the last how many years of making you.
Yes.
Give me that money right now. That's insane. Yes. You wouldn't expect that of a child or, you know, something that you've crafted and something that's
an expression. In this example, our work is our children.
Our musical works.
Yes. Our art is our children, and we want them to pay us back
right,
for their existence.
Right, exactly. Yes. And, you know, eventually, of course, that you would like your children to be very successful and look after you when you're in a nursing home.
Yes. But retire on them.
To follow this long drawn out metaphor, you know, you work so that you can provide for your art and your kids.
Okay, yes.
Moving kids away. But you're working so you can provide for your art and your creative output. And I then sort of switched and was like, I will happily talk about my side hustles. I will celebrate them because they allow me to do what I'm doing.
I mean, the other thing, yes, totally. And also, when you refer to the Carole King, James Taylor project that you built, I think that's still very much in line with your career. And even this mystery side hustle that we're going to get to in a second, I still think is in alignment with the general shape of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But also, we are all multifaceted.
Yeah.
We just are, you know, and the idea that there's one primary dominant thing that defines us and everything else is in the way of that is, I just don't accept that, because I think, and maybe for some people there are single-minded, but even Sam, who is a ridiculous saxophone player and I'm sure puts in so much time on his craft, is also a hilarious creator.
Absolutely.
And a funny presenter of things and a band leader and a multitude of things. Like, 30 years ago, we might have said, like, his job is just, like, play the saxophone. But today, that's just one of many things that he's doing to build a career.
Yeah.
So you have been working in a management office.
Yes.
Working in the management of other artists, basically.
Yeah. I'll name drop him because he's awesome.
Yeah.
I work with Andrew Lieb over in LA, who has Deep Phil Talent Co. And we manage a roster of artists. And I basically am his day-to-day. And honestly, it's probably the best side hustle I could have worked towards, considering what I do for my artistry. Because I have this eye into the industry from the other side of the table. And it's so helpful. And I'm learning stuff every single day. I'm meeting people who are so awesome. And all the artists and Andrew and everyone knows that I also do my artistry. And my and that was the first thing I told them. I was like, look, I'm a type A. I'm good at management, but this is my dream. And the whole way through, they've been insanely supportive, everyone. And I don't take that for granted. I think that's really important.
Did you have to agree that you wouldn't exploit any relationships that you develop working for Andrew for your own career?
Absolutely. No, I'm really careful with that. I will ask him whenever. Yeah. If there's someone I'd love to reach out to, I ask him first.
Yeah.
And he has also been incredible. He put me in touch with Andrew Friedman over at RAG, who knew who I was, but through a few different people. Yeah. But Andrew made the email connection. And now I'm on RAG. I'm with Royal Artists.
Uh-huh.
And they're my agents. And that's really, really awesome. Yeah. And and I think there's a really important thing when you're figuring out maybe what your side hustle should be, or what you could be doing for money, what you could be hustling. What are your limitations?
Mm-hmm.
And also, what are you good at that you may not say, that it's not very glamorous to be really good at spreadsheets and type A and organization and emails? It's not very glamorous, but people bloody need that.
Yes.
They need that. The industry needs that. You need that for yourself. So the more you flex those muscles and earn money, brilliant, excellent, the more you can support yourself as an artist too. Like you said, we are multifaceted, and I think that should be celebrated and not seen as a hindrance in a world that, you know, really does need you to be marketable. And we can circle back on that. And there are so many what ifs. They are a waste of time.
Yeah.
They are a waste of your time. They are a waste of your energy. For whatever reason, you have ended up in this situation.
Yeah.
You've fallen in love.
Yes.
You've brought life into this world. Yeah, yeah. You've done all these incredible things. I've moved to New York. I've moved in to one of the most expensive cities in the world for a reason. I'm going to make it work. You're going to make it work. Yes. Like, the what ifs are very dangerous, and they come to us in the dead of night and they eat away at our brains and they give us insomnia. But the world doesn't care about what ifs. The industry doesn't care about what ifs. Your bills don't care about what ifs. Your family doesn't care about what ifs. Also, your dreams don't care about what ifs, because that, again, is going to crush them instead of support them. And looking at yourself in the present and saying, what can I do now to support my dreams? Yeah. And what can I do now to achieve my goals?
Yeah.
That is the only thing you should be focusing on.
Yeah.
And that is very Sam Harris.
Yes.
Embrace your skills and limitations and how you can earn money to support your art.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if it's not glamorous. Figure out something that makes you feel good. Yeah. I feel great when I send a good email.
Yeah.
Do you know what one of my favorite things I do that I don't admit because it's not glamorous? Routing tours.
Yes.
Like opening a map and putting in venues that I have offers in or that I know people. I did this for two house show tours, right? In 2023. Yeah. Sent out a blast on Instagram. Anyone want me to play at their house? Blah, blah, blah. I got people sending me through all over the country. Literally New York, Chicago, Nashville, San Diego, LA, Iowa, one in the middle of the country. Yeah. I was like, how do I make this work? Yeah. And I pulled it up on a map and I pulled up Toll Pass or whatever the website is. It's so good. And you can
Wait, what
put
is Toll Pass?
I
don't know Toll Pass.
It's like, it's not Toll Pass. What is it? It's Toll Roads or tollsomething.com. And you can put in multi, it's like AA start, planner, but you can put in multi stops and it tells you how much gas you're going to use, how many miles it is, what tolls you're going to go through. Mate.
Right.
It's my favorite thing. And I do it. I use it every time I plan a tour. I immediately, and I kind of relish that. I kind of love that because it's something that gets my type A brain moving and just sort of like probably ADD of some kind, getting everything into a spreadsheet, getting everything listed.
I need to show you some spreadsheets before we leave because every night this is what I do.
Oh my gosh.
Every night.
I think we should have spreadsheet awards and I would put forward many of mine.
I want you to show me some shit before you leave because I'm like running into some obstacles and I need some help.
Oh my God, let's have a spreadsheet. Right. Let's have fun. Anyway, but that shit, you know, it's like so unglamorous, but it's also, being an independent artist, you got to book your own tours, make your own press releases. You have to, you know, outreach to anyone and everyone. So you have to know how to put a good industry email together. You have to know how to build a one sheet. You have to.
So, okay. So some questions here. These are actually just genuinely curious for myself also. Like, how is your time divided in terms of organizing, for example, putting a show together? You're going to do a bunch of house shows.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have your set kind of together. You have to have your solo thing dialed. When are you putting that together? How are you putting that together? How is that just something that you've built and developed and it's there for you? Are you having to maintain just your artistic craft in the midst of all this other stuff?
Yeah, that is, I mean, I try to have shows relatively regularly throughout the year.
Yeah.
I'm prepping for my debut headline tour right now.
Yeah.
So I'm deep in band rehearsals and building tracks and putting that show together. That is this week's
assignment.
The assignment. And I had a big launch for the album and I put a lot of work into prepping for that show. So it really revolves around when I have shows. Do I practice every day? No, I don't. I should. I could. I will. But there's also a billion other things happening and I'm okay with my level of rehearsal and time that I build into the shows right now. If I feel like I haven't got enough time, I will panic and I will feel really, really bad about that. And I have been in that position before. Yeah. So I will try and far enough out from the shows, dial in half days throughout the week, 3 to 4 hours of just sit in front of the piano, figure out what you're going to do. At the end of the day, you put all of this work to take a show onto the road. It better be a good show.
Yeah.
Because if the final hurdle of it just being a mediocre show is what happens, then all of that work was for nothing. So I think that is really important to make sure that you're taking a strong representation of what you do out on the road. Otherwise, there's no point really.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You just got to be smart.
Well, some of that is also like the question is, are you burned out? You know, like, do you burn out doing the side hustle? And then when it's time, finally, you've like earned your time for yourself. Are you there? Can you be fresh? Not just you, but can one show up for themselves after having shown up for everybody else?
You can. I would build in break
time.
And that's it's very hard for hustling musicians because we feel like we have to hustle every day of every week of every year. I'm not very good at daily practices to stop myself burning out. I need to be better at this. I probably need to meditate more. Yeah. I probably need to get off my phone more. I welcome any advice you might have for not burning out while you're in the thing.
Yeah.
My methods at the moment are just go, go, go.
Yeah.
And allow yourself to not go for like a week.
Right.
Or
and
so.
Restore it. That's restore, the restorative.
And try and give yourself grace in that week to be like, don't look at your phone. Just it's the weekend or it's yeah. Thanksgiving or it's Christmas or something. Just like try and leave it behind and give yeah. yourself this time because yeah. you worked so, so hard before that time.
And it goes in waves too. You know, I mean, it Absolutely. Goes in phases. There was a time when you were listening to Sam Harris and vegan. Or
that,
no, you're still vegan.
I'm still vegan.
Yeah, but you were not
there was
drinking.
A time where I wasn't drinking and yeah. I was listening to Sam Harris and I was meditating.
Yeah.
I don't know where she's gone. Where has that Phoebe gone?
What about, do you journal?
I used to journal.
Yeah.
I used to journal religiously.
Was it helpful?
It was. It was. And then it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was. And then it was just me looking at a page thinking that I had just had to write down my negative thoughts. And actually, I was starting to dwell on my negativity more than my positivity. Yeah. And it wasn't helping.
Yeah.
I do think journaling is very important. Yeah. I want it to come into my life naturally instead of forcing it, which people who journal are probably like, no, you should do your morning pages and journal and whether you want to or not. And that's the point.
That's
and I'm like, I absolutely hear that. I will endeavor to get back into some formality around it. But
I hit it really hard at the beginning of this year, probably for the first 4 or 5 months of the year, wake up, nice. Meditate and journal
oh, wow.
and
okay,
just a
yeah.
few, you know, the morning pages. And then it's like exercise or anything else. It's like the second you take a day off or a week off, then just getting back onto it, it's just hard, so much harder to climb back yes. onto it once you get off of it.
Try to give yourself grace in yeah. what you can and can't do and what you can and can't make time for instead of feeling like,
right.
well, Beyonce also has 24 hours in the day.
Or Corey fucking Wong. I mean, that's the yeah, one that Corey. I can't understand how he does what yeah. he does. I don't understand how he does it.
He's a machine.
Having seen the thing operate, is he a machine?
Something he told me, which really helped, was he goes to the studio
yeah.
and works as if it's his day job.
Yeah.
So he will get up and go to the studio at 9 o'clock in the morning
yeah.
and he'll leave at 5.
Yeah.
And he'll give himself a working day
yeah.
at the studio, or at his desk and whatever it is, around his family time so that he can be both.
Yeah.
And that's also something that
very
Again,
Nashville. That's a very Nashville mentality.
Even though
he's
yeah.
Minneapolis, but he's Nashville too. He's,
yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's really important because yeah. I think you forget that too. Because the tortured artist thing, where
yes.
you're like up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're writing, and or you're like gigging 5 days a week and burning yourself out and not being able to get up in the morning, or what is it? It's like those days I think are kind of gone. If you want to achieve stability with your artistry,
yes.
Stability, meaning emotional, financial stability. You have to treat it like a day job. It's a career. And I think that's very important. You have to take the reins of it first, because the romantic finding an artist in the smoky room of a club in the 2000s and making them a pop star overnight, that's TikTok.
Yeah.
Effectively, that's TikTok. And what's the number one thing they tell you about TikTok? Consistency. Mm. Post all the time. Post every day. Be in this content making mindset, which it drives me insane.
But it's also dangerous emotionally to have to
absolutely.
Do that.
Absolutely. It's dangerous, but also it is one of the things that yeah. is now an industry standard.
Yes.
And that really sucks on the one hand, because I don't want to be sat in front of my blooming phone making like da-da-da-da-da, singing along. I want to be out there. I want to be gigging. I want to be doing this, doing that. But for whatever reason, however it's happened, the industry has moved onto the internet, and the live
yeah.
industry is still there.
Yes.
I hope.
No, I think it feeds, you know, in the last week or 2 weeks, I interviewed Stella Cole. I don't know
yeah.
if you know who she is.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
then I interviewed Dodie the other day.
Yes. Oh,
and
Dodie's
these
amazing.
Are two people who do very different
mm-hmm.
work.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, right now, both signed to Decca, and yeah. but also have a life on stage now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was born out of staring at the blooming phone.
Yeah, exactly. Dodie from the YouTube era yeah, yes. and Stella from the TikTok and Instagram
yeah.
era.
Yeah.
yeah. They used the tools that were hot right now in the yeah. industry at that time to break themselves through. And they did that.
Yeah.
They did that first before any big dogs in the industry took note. And I think that's something really important to remember. It's like, what are your tools that you can use right now as yeah. an artist? Like, as sucky as it is to have to make all these videos on TikTok and Instagram and try and work out the algorithm gods,
yeah.
like it's not always all about that. But on the one hand, for certain people in the industry, for example, for booking agents to see numbers and like be convinced that you're going to sell tickets, where are they going to look? They're going to look online, which is crazy because that's not where your audience are. But, you know, and all of these things, unfortunately, that is the reality of the industry at this point.
You know, part of it is a fundamental shift in terms of what you think you're doing. Like if one thing is I'm making this thing because I love it and I'm trying to figure out how to message it to people.
Yeah.
That's one version of the job. The other is, oh, this is what's responding. This is what the algorithm is taking. And mm-hmm. so I need to shift what I make for the algorithm. And that's a very fine line to walk because, I mean, if you still feel okay about that shift, mm-hmm. it's supporting some larger thing like getting people to your shows or something, yes. But if you find that you're writing different songs now or the sound mm-hmm. of the music is different or whatever, like at what point have we stepped too far away from the thing that we meant to do?
Absolutely. And I think that circles right back around to the beginning when we were talking about my new album.
Yes.
I did not market it the way it's supposed to. It was not a smart career move.
Yeah.
You know, Spotify hears good days. Wherever I am is where I wanna be. Even if the grass appears greener, it's a fantasy. Wherever you are is where you're meant to be. Yeah. Good days are what you let them be. And then they get Chronic People Pleaser and they're like, what is she doing?
Right.
So that's where I didn't necessarily market it career-wise.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. But this, thank you for saying some song names because I wanted to ask you about a couple of them, including Chronic People Pleaser. Are you one?
Absolutely. Yeah, that one is straight therapy.
Yeah.
In a song. And it's funny because I sort of span out about that too and was like, do people think me calling myself a chronic people pleaser is me saying I'm a really good person because I just think about everyone else? And literally, I texted my friend this and she was like, Phoebe, that is quite literally what you're talking about in the song. You're worrying about what other people think about you.
That's so true.
In the song where you're saying you worry about what, because inherently as a chronic people pleaser.
Because if you don't like me saying that, I don't have to say that. I could say something else. If you don't like it when I say I'm a people pleaser, I'll say it a different way. Yeah. And if that would please you more, I could change it.
Exactly. It's so dumb. But the heart of that song is literally that I will just go out of my way to put everyone else first, which inherently sounds like, yay, look at me. But it's also, it's chronic. It's bad. It's like, I don't make time for myself. I don't make time for my art. I take a lot of time and energy away from myself because I want to do favors for people and do this and do that, which is not great. Firstly, it's just not great for me, I think. But it also is just my inherent need for people to like me. So, again, it's all selfish. It's all completely selfish.
Well, that ties back to where we started also, which is like, is it selfish or is it selfless? Is it like, is it selfless to be a giving person? Depends. I mean, so, you know.
Oh, yeah. On paper, I look really selfless. Yeah. What a nice person.
Yeah.
But inherently, I just want you to like me, so I'm going to do things for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
just the spinning out about it, I could go for it.
But I do think that that's a big part of what makes what you're doing unique, is that it is filled with a lot of honesty and directness and willingness to name those things. And like, that's what I was saying, it's easy to look past it because it's kind of in a shiny package. Mm-hmm. You know, it's these, as you say, it's these bops, but it's like, you say real shit inside of those shiny packages, including raising the question about what it means to be a people pleaser, or thinking about mortality and aging and really allowing yourself to speak about it, wanting a family and saying that. There's so many things like that that I think are really special about what you're doing. So
thank you.
I congratulate you on this record.
Thank you so much. And I hope it's somewhat cohesive in the fact that it's from me and my brain.
Yes.
I think some people have been saying like, what do you mean it's not cohesive? Like, it's you and your voice.
Yes.
But I'm really stoked with how it's been received. I'm really excited for it to be out in the world. And I've had a lot of very, very sweet messages. I'm really lucky. Yeah. Like, a lot of people have been like, oh my God, Chronic People Pleaser, that's me in a song. Yeah. And I'm like, oh yeah, you're good.
Because it's true that the personal is universal. And when you talk about yourself, people yes. often will see themselves in it, I think.
Yeah, that is always true, I think. And maybe that's the answer to our first selfless or selfish question yes. is the personal is always universal.
Yeah.
And if you say something in a certain way, it might move someone else
yes.
and help them with whatever they're going through. That, I think, is just my constant thread that I come back to. It's just like, maybe someone feels better about themselves if they hear this song.
Sure. Phoebe Kadis, thank you for making the personal universal today with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations.
I didn't gush about this third story, though, because I love this podcast. I've been listening to it for years, and I'm just so honored to be here.
Oh.
So that's that. So thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, of course. Thank you for being here. There she was, my friends, Phoebe Kadis. Coming of age, pleasing people, side hustling, doing it all. The Third Story is produced and hosted by me, Leo Sidran. Today's episode was edited with help from Ray Long. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.